The merciful, the creator and sustainer of the universe. Peace and blessings upon his servant and messenger Muhammad forever. Ameen. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you. Welcome to another episode of Islam in Focus. Today we have our 15th program in our series dealing with the economic system of Islam. We'll be continuing our discussion of distribution and looking at the topic of zakat and distribution of income. I'm your host, Amr Rashid, and I have joining me, as usual, Dr. Jamal Badawi of St. Mary's University. Brother Jamal, assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah.
I wonder if I could get you very quickly to highlight the main points that we touched on last week in our program.
Okay. In the 15th program, we started first by finishing a few points pertaining to the previous discussion on interest and interest dealing that has been forbidden by Islam. And we indicated that the prohibition of interest dealing in Islam does not necessarily mean prohibition of saving or investment. And we have seen that there are so many Islamically acceptable alternatives for investment in a variety of ways, partnership of varieties of form, using your own funds for your own business, buying common stocks from the market in permissible areas, of course. And the main point that was clarified is that an important principle in Islamic law, which is called Al-Ghulmu Bil-Ghulmu, that if you're exposed to profit, you must be exposed to loss. If you get smaller profit, you can get larger profit depending on the actual performance, rather than any prearranged advance percentage. We also touched briefly on the function of banking system under an Islamic economy, and he said that it does not mean that you have to cancel banking as a system at all, but that the functions of banking would be more like service, investment, mutual fund type of thing, but not necessarily exactly the same way that they are operating today. And finally, there was a brief discussion on the question of consumption loans and government debts. And then we moved into the last or the third aspect of the main issues that we were dealing in on the economic system, that distribution. And we said that in the matter of distribution, the basic rule is that the government should not interfere in determining prices artificially, that the normal forces of supply and demand should be let to determine the price, unless there is a basic disequilibrium or exploitation in the market whereby the government may interfere to make sure that the basic needs of people are met without undue exploitation. And finally, a similar problem also is raised. What happens if a person monopolizes and withholds some of the basic foodstuff which are needed for people? Can he be forced to sell? And again, we said that if an emergency like that arises, he may be forced to sell, but not at an arbitrary price, rather at a fair and equitable type of price. After all, the Prophet has said in one of the sayings, Al-Muhtakiru Mal'un, that is, the person who deliberately withholds or monopolizes is a cursed person. So this is part of both economic as well as moral teaching of Islam.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, continuing with our discussion of distribution, in Islam, the use of a middleman or a broker in distribution, is this what is the viewpoint on the middleman or brokers in Islam?
Okay, in principle, there's no difficulty with that. If a person is doing a function as a middle person, and he's getting some pay for that, there's nothing wrong with it. But there's only one thing that Islam restricts, and that is people who act as middle persons for the purpose of exploiting people's lack of knowledge and information. In other words, to put it in economic terms, what Islam insists on in its economic system is the free flow of information between the buyers and sellers. To give you an example of this, it was reported in Bukhari that the Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, tried to stop, put a stop to the practice where a producer, for example, producer-seller comes or bring his things to sell, and before he reaches the market, somebody intercepts him and he says to him, all right, why didn't you sell that to me at this price and I'll sell it for you? And then he takes it and sells it at much higher price. This was forbidden because the idea here is that the seller should come first to the market, find out what is the going rate for his product, and then determine how much he wants to sell. But to exploit this gap of information is restricted. But otherwise, any activity by way of helping people with free flow of information is not restricted in itself, so long as there is a specific service. Of course, in today's complex economy, you can do away with all middle persons, but you can reduce the number and again provide information.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, earlier you mentioned that Islam attempts to achieve justice both in terms of distribution of commodities as well as in distribution of income. Could you perhaps explain for us some of the means that are employed by Islam to provide for the distributive justice that is implicit in this?
Okay. Well, the most important means would be zakat. I translate it more as, institutionalized charity. Secondly, there's the voluntary charity. Thirdly, there is also the possibility of additional taxes beyond the minimum required in institutionalized charity. It could also be achieved through the law of inheritance in Islam. These are basically some of the major means of achieving some kind of social justice and more equitable distribution of income in society. It's not only just distribution of commodities, but also equitable distribution of income.
Mm-hmm. Well, maybe we could explore some of these in a little bit more detail, dealing first of all, or beginning with some discussion of zakat. Could you tell us what it is and perhaps explain the meaning of the term zakat?
Okay. On the question of zakat, I'd just like to make a cross-reference here because in a previous program in the series E, or the Pillars of Islam, the seventh program, we dealt with zakat even though mainly as one of the basic pillars of Islam.
Mm-hmm.
So you probably might make some reference to some of the material we discussed there, but perhaps putting it in a different way or looking from a different angle this time. But basically, to start with, zakah is one of the main pillars, one of the five basic pillars of Islam. It has been mentioned in the Quran in conjunction with prayers, which is one of the most important requirements for Muslims. More than 80, I should say, verses in the Quran. It has been mentioned in the Quran with the consequences of those who pay zakah being rewarded by God and those who do not being punished by God. Just a good quick reference, because this we discussed in that program, just a cross reference to the verses, like in 24:56, in 2:24 on, in 9:34, in 51 verses 15 through 19. In all of these there is a vivid picture showing how important the zakah as an institution in a truly Islamic society. But from the linguistic point of view, etymologically speaking, mm-hmm. zakah means two things. It means purification, and it means also growth. It is purification because it purifies oneself from selfishness and miserliness. And in a way, also, this results in blessing. And this blessing, by the way, is not only just spiritual blessing or growth. It could be spiritual blessing, but as we will see, it has also economic blessing in the long term, as it affects the individual and society at large. So I'm trying to emphasize here that aside from any other aspects of zakah or purification, it has to be based in the first place on faith in God, the love of God, the feeling of responsibility as the trustee of God on earth, and as we discussed in previous program, that whatever property we have is a trust given to us by God, so we have to dispense with it in ways which are pleasing and acceptable to Him. But the point also to add here is that zakah, or institutionalized charity, is not merely a sort of religious spiritual preaching. It is partly spiritual, there's no question about that. But if it is only spiritual, it would be just like any universal motherhood statement any religion, for that matter, or any philosophy would call people to be charitable. But zakah in Islam is quite unique. It is much more than that. It is a combination of the spiritual, ethical aspect, as well as the meticulous organization and institutionalization. It has aspects which are social, political, and even economic.
Mm-hmm. Well, perhaps could you explain for us how and why zakat is more comprehensive than other teachings that about charity?
You mean other than generalities or urging for charity?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, it is quite different. And perhaps one of the good references that I found dealing with this is what I understand was originally a doctoral dissertation by Dr. Sheikh Yusuf Al-Qaradawi. And this appeared in a two-volume work, which is perhaps one of the most comprehensive works on zakah. It's called Fiqh al-Zakah, or Understanding of Zakah.
Mm-hmm.
And in this reference, as in other references in Islamic literature dealing with zakah, one can easily point out to, first, social aspects of zakah, besides the spiritual that we have discussed. In a way, zakah can be regarded as a sort of social insurance against involuntary unemployment. It could be social insurance against inability to work, against certain disasters or unfortunate events that may take place. And this would give a sort of feeling of brotherhood, solidarity within society, which would reduce jealousy. It would reduce class struggle, as you might hear that term used frequently. It makes members of society feel that they belong. It enriches this feeling of belonging within the members of society, so that you don't get too many people who feel anti-society and anti-social, and sometimes would be driven even to crime because of this lack of feeling of belonging. In a way, also, it is both social, psychological also, because it trains the individual to have a feeling of social concern,
mm-hmm.
to stop this apathy that's destroying societies today, as you are aware. It makes the person feel part of the system. And it's not like other pension systems, for example, because in many of the pension schemes, it depends on how much you contributed or whether or not you contributed. Mm-hmm. In an Islamic system, regardless of your contribution, big or small, still you are entitled for this social security, aside from any other consideration. Secondly, it could also be regarded as a political system, because zakah, or institutionalized charity, can be regarded as a mechanism which joins together the various segments of society and various groups within the society with the view of serving their mutual interest and their mutual concern. But perhaps one of the most interesting and important elements of zakah, of charity, is even economical.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, the system of zakah in Islam is one of the important means of fighting one of the greatest enemies of mankind, poverty, which is, of course, an international problem faced in the East and West, as you're all aware. But still, it tried to fight poverty without necessarily killing the individual initiative. It recognizes still that people can have differences in their capabilities, mm-hmm. and their talents. And Islam does not insist on superficial full equality in a sense that everybody must get the same income. But in the meantime, it tries to work from there to reduce the big gaps between the rich and poor. So it allows for initiative, but in the meantime, looks after the needs of those who need also. A second economic aspect is that zakah, being an annual, regular, determined type of thing, provides for a stable source of income for the state to meet certain expenses and needs. A third aspect, which sometimes is not as clear, but it's very important in terms of its economic implication, is that by its very nature, the system of zakah, or institutionalized charity in Islam, forces the individual to invest his money and discourages hoarding of money. Why? Because it's imposed every year. No matter how small the percentage may be, if you're not investing that money, you just keep paying the required charity on it, so you're going to lose it. So that, in a way, provides a strong inducement for people who have wealth to use it and not to withhold it from circulation. And as we have indicated in a previous program, there are many economists who feel that this is very essential for the health of the economy, because if people are keeping wealth from use, then of course you get depression and you get lots of economic problems and decline. But when people invest their money, then it provides for jobs for others and general prosperity in the economy. No wonder then we find many like those who studied the system of zakah in Islam, both Muslims and non-Muslims, I've given already one Muslim scholar who have written extensively on that, conclude that the system of zakah in Islam is quite unique. It has never been preceded before by any law or even religious teaching. It's quite a comprehensive thing. It's not just a matter of motherhood statement of being charitable. It's much more than that.
Well, now, based on my understanding, zakat and taxes are not the same kind of thing at all. Could you perhaps just clarify what the main differences between the two are?
Well, the reason that sometimes zakat is mixed with taxes is due to the fact that even though there are differences, there are still some limited points of similarities, I should say, between between zakat and taxes. At least three. Well, both zakah and taxes are compulsory. Both are required. So this is one thing. Secondly, both also are to be collected by a given authority, the government, let's say. Thirdly, both zakah and taxes are collected by virtue of being a member in society. So it's not collected because of a certain specific service that you have received, but in general by being a member of society and part of a total social solidarity, if you want. However, as you indicated quite rightfully in your question, there are definitely some basic and fundamental differences between zakah and taxes. First of all, as indicated earlier, the very term zakah itself means blessing, means purification, and should be done and paid by the Muslim essentially as a matter of worship. It's one of those five basic acts of commitment or submission to God. And this makes it quite different from taxes. Because if you feel that you're paying your fair share and you're doing that out of your obligation towards God above all, you don't try to find ways to evade taxes. Most people will try to avoid, not even to avoid paying taxes. In fact, we find a very interesting example that was narrated both in Ahmad and At-Tabarani Al-Kabir. When some individuals came to Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, and he was not aware that they have gained additional wealth. He wasn't aware of that. And they said, "We've got this additional wealth and we would like to purify our wealth. So please tell us, you know, how we have to pay zakah on it." So people coming voluntarily saying, "Yes, you're not aware that I got that money, you know, I have to pay my share of it." And again, why? Because it's not just something that the state imposes, but they know that this is worship to God and obedience to Him. A second basic difference is that when you talk about taxes, as you know from reviewing any budget, it's dependent on the government. If they say taxes today is 15%, tomorrow 17%, day after tomorrow 15%, you know, they determine the amount totally according to the need of the country and sometimes the whims of those in power. In the case of zakah in Islam, however, we find that the Quran itself, which is the word of God for the Muslim, may establish the principle of zakah. The teaching of the Prophet determine a specific percentage of zakah, which nobody has the right to change. We're talking here about the minimum. So the minimum for zakah is there, nobody can change that. And it has to be a separate budget also, because the collection of zakah, or charity in Islam, would have to be directed to certain specified purposes, as the Quran indicates, 8 particular categories of expenditures. And it does not necessarily automatically go for any other expenditure by the state. And this is the second. A third characteristic or difference, of course, is derived from these two differences. And that is the system of zakah in Islam is much more stable and constant because of this lack of argument as to what the rate should be. The rate has already been set, so there isn't much dispute or time wasted in that particular thing. One should add, however, that an interesting feature of the system of zakah in Islam is that it is the money or the property collected from those who are able to, the rich, and going back to the poor. Whereas in the system of taxation, it's usually imposed on everybody, of course, but a big burden actually falls on the middle class, so-called, and even the poor. And sometimes it is a reverse financing when some of those who are well-to-do get so many tax concessions and know how to play the game. So in a way, it's almost like in some cases the poor financing the rich, if we were to exaggerate it a little bit. But in Islam, it's strictly something to be taken from those who are able to help those who are really in need. It's not the reverse.
Well, now, in the calculation of zakat, is it done on the basis of capital or on the basis of income?
Well, we cannot exactly say, for example, that the system of zakat or charity in Islam is exclusively income tax. Because, after all, in the system that Islam provides, not every item of your income is subject to zakat. For example, the part of your income which is used or consumed for basic needs, like food, clothing, housing, transportation, and so on, that is not subject to zakat. It's, if I will call it, non-zakatable. Term that has been used recently. In a way, you can say that zakat is primarily imposed on your net worth, but it avoids the faults and difficulties with taxes which are imposed on capital, because of course many people say if you impose taxes on capital, then you are in effect discouraging people from saving or investing. But this is not the case in Islam for at least three reasons. One, zakah in Islam is imposed on property which is potentially growing, that could be subject to growth and investment. To clarify that, for example, there is no zakah due on the jewelry which the woman keeps for her personal use, for example, because this is not something that gives any additional wealth, it's just for her own use. No zakah on your professional tools for the whatever profession, plumber, doctor, whatever. Thirdly, there is no zakah on your principal residence or home or your car. Even if you're a merchant, you pay zakah only on articles of trade. You don't pay it on fixed assets like shelving and other things that you use to do your business. A second reason why it's better than any other tax that's imposed on capital is that it is very modest and reasonable. We're really talking here about, most commonly, 2.5% per year, which is, I think, quite reasonable. And thirdly, there is a minimum also which is exempt, usually estimated at about 85 grams of gold or or their equivalent, of course, in money.
Mm-hmm.
But I should add also that there may be also certain types of zakah which are subject or are imposed on income, like income from agriculture or self-employment. There are certain specific taxes on metals or oil, by analogy, that comes from the earth. It's not exclusively really either income or capital type of tax.
Mm-hmm. Well, now I'm sure some people who are watching the program, particularly those who have been listening to the various budgets that have been brought down by the provincial and federal governments, would say, surely this sounds good, but there isn't any way that you can finance government expenditures in today's economy with simply using a rate of zakat of 2.5%.
Right.
How would you respond to the skeptics?
Okay. Well, first of all, when you talk about the tax rates in Western economies, for example, when you talk about 30% and 25%, you're really talking about income tax, something which is imposed on income. In the case of Islam, it is imposed on net worth.
Yes.
So it might sound small on the surface, but as you know, the net worth is much more than an income in a given particular year. So like a person might have, for example, 5-6 high rises that he's renting. So you're really paying zakat on the net worth, not just on the income from them. So this is one thing that, to clarify, to be much more than it, what it appears to be. Indeed, historically speaking, as has been mentioned in a previous program, during the reign of Umar ibn Abdul Aziz, nearly the end of the first century of Hijrah or migration, zakah from North Africa was collected, and there were not enough poor people even to claim it. That's why he instructed his local ruler to buy slaves and set them free, because there was no needy. So historically it was possible, and I'm sure today even, if you take just the Muslim world, if Muslims are true to their faith and everybody's paying this 2.5% on net worth, I'm sure that there will be no single person who would be left hungry or in need. So if everybody does that in a sincere and conscious way, it definitely should be enough. However, we're not saying that zakah is the exclusive source of income for government. There are amount of money that is collected by way of taxes on the produce of the land, jizya, which is the equivalent of zakah. Muslim pay zakah, and Muslim pay something equivalent to that to share also in the overall costs of running the state. The property which doesn't have any person to claim or inherit, and if need be, even it could be additional taxes beyond zakah.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, in a few minutes that we have remaining today's program, is there any basis for making the rate of zakat flexible? Can it be flexible more than 2.5%? And if so, what is the basis for that?
Well, as far as zakat itself, it's a stable thing. Nobody has the right to change, because that has been given in Revelation. So there's no room. And if you open the door again for zakat to be flexible, every government can, you know, exploit that, and you could get unjust rulers who try to play around with it. So this is a permanent, which is 2.5%, and that's very reasonable, not very excessive. But in the meantime, we find that Islam have also allowed the state, a just ruler or just government, to impose additional taxes if there is need for that, and if the amount of zakah is not enough. But you have first to start from zakah. If it's not enough, then you can move to some other. There are a number of evidences that the Quran, for example, speaks about both paying zakah, and it talks also about being charitable, as we find in chapter 2, verse 177. Prophet Muhammad, peace be upon him, as narrated in At-Tirmidhi, he said it clearly, that in your property there is a claim beyond the amount of zakah. And this is a very sound type of tradition, which is very strong. And there are also additional things, additional texts, that seem to indicate that zakah is the bare minimum. It doesn't mean that you say, I pay 2.5%, there's nothing else. But there must be some guarantees. There must be a genuine need for additional funds beyond zakah. Secondly, it should be distributed in terms of burden in an equitable way. it should also be spent wisely, and it must be done only after the approval and consent of the in a consultative way with the representatives of the people.
Well, our time is gone for today. We want to thank you for watching our program and invite you back next week when we'll continue our series dealing with the economic system of Islam. Thank you for watching. Assalamu alaikum. Peace be unto you.